Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, I do want to say something I never think to say in these podcasts is that if you want to support the work of Crisis Magazine and what we're doing at crisismagazine.com and here on the Crisis Point Podcast, please feel free to donate. You can just go crisismagazine.com/donate. And make a regular monthly contribution or a one-time contribution, whatever the case may be. But, you know, we appreciate your donations. We're completely supported by them. And so if you'd like to do that, please do so. This is our 42nd, I think, podcast. And this is the first time I remember to say that. So maybe make up for those other 41 times and donate a lot this time. Okay, so let's get going here. Today, I'm going to probably get in trouble. Because I'm going to engage in a little bit of speculative theology, I guess you'd call it, really, and I titled this podcast Rethinking the Papacy, which I think the title alone is enough to make most Catholics nervous. And I don't blame them for being nervous for such a title, Rethinking the Papacy, because really, in so many ways, our Catholics, modern Catholics, Roman Catholics, view of the papacy has been formed in the fires of the Protestant Reformation and, of course, the Catholic Counter-Reformation. That our view of the papacy has really developed over the last 500 years as a bulwark against Protestantism. We see the papacy as our means by which we can maintain Orthodox doctrine, that we can maintain the church that Jesus Christ has founded. It's like he's our leader in battle against the Protestants. And for most of those 500 years, that's exactly what the Pope has done. However, I think we know that the current status, the current occupant, I should say, of the papal office, and even the occupants, some of the occupants that preceded him, immediately preceded him, have been problematic. Let's just say that's my weasel word for being a disaster in some cases. And so what's happened is that Francis has posed a challenge to faithful Catholics. On the one hand, his embrace of the modern world, and I think most of it would say even modernism in a lot of ways, has led to a lot of Catholics re-embracing the traditions of the Catholic Church. I mean, those of us who go to a traditional Latin Mass, for example, have seen a huge increase over the past few years. And I think a lot of that is in reaction to Pope Francis, that a lot of Catholics are seeing that he is the epitome of this post-Vatican II Catholicism, this post-Vatican II project. And so in reaction, they are seeing that, hey, we want the fullness of the Catholic tradition. We don't want just the last 60 years, we want the whole 2000 years. And so they've embraced a more traditional practice of the faith. But at the same time, that has also led, the problems with the Francis pontificate have led a lot of Catholics to rethink or at least try to figure out what does this mean for the papacy? And the truth is it's because our views of the papacy are basically, for more traditional Catholics, are very much set in the early 20th century. And we see statements by popes like Pope Leo XIII, Pope Pius XI, which I think I'll get into here a little bit later, that talk about the fact that we have to follow the Pope in everything, that we have to even just agree with his opinions, that we have no real right to disagree even with the opinions of a Pope. Well, now we have a problem. Now we have a dichotomy here. We have people wanting to embrace a more traditional aspect of the faith because of Francis. But because of Francis, they're seeing problems with some of this papal theology of the papacy, that evolved over the centuries, particularly in the last 150 years or so, maybe 200 years. And so I think what's happened is we've fallen into, I would say, five options that have five responses to the Francis pontificate, I think have arisen because of, you know, the problematic things that Francis says and does. And basically, let me break them down for you The first option is what I would call the nuclear option. It's deny the Catholic Church as the true Church of Christ. This is okay, because of Francis and maybe JP II or Paul or even Benedict, I'm just going to give up on the whole project. I'm just going to give up on Catholicism. I'm either going to go to Eastern Orthodoxy or Protestantism, or just leave the faith completely and become an atheist. And so this is what I would say is like the nuclear option. This is basically, we're having a problem with Francis. Francis is saying things that directly contradict previous popes and teachings of the church at times. So what do? We just deny it's possible. So if the Pope is saying something that contradicts previous teaching, then the whole thing falls apart. It's a house of cards. And I wrote an article about this at Crisis a while back. Obviously, this is not a good option. But that's kind of the first reaction somebody could have. The second one is sedevacantism, which is deny a bad pope is the pope. So if we have a bad pope, we would just deny that he's the pope. We'd say, no, he's not a valid pope for whatever reason. Maybe it's because his election wasn't valid. Maybe it's because the previous pope didn't properly resign his office. Maybe it's because there hasn't been a valid pope since the 50s. Maybe it's because by the very fact of him saying something that we believe is heretical, therefore he loses the office automatically. Lots of different ways you can come to this conclusion. But this is another reaction, which is deny a bad pope as a pope. Now, I'm not going to get into addressing this one here. There's been lots of ink spilled, or I guess pixels created to respond to this. I think it's a spiritually and ecclesiastical dead end, to be honest. So I'm not going to get into it right now, but that is something some Catholics are doing. The third option is we deny that a bad pope is bad. And this is the pope-splaining option that, oh no, he's not really contradicting previous teachings. He's not really saying these things. You know, it's a bad interpretation. It's a bad translation. I mean, it's just something that he didn't really mean it like this. Oh, you have to understand he's Argentinian, or I don't know, from Argentina, or whatever the case may be. So this is the pope-splaining explanation. I think this one's just rationally inconsistent. It's irrational. The fact of the matter is that Pope Francis has said things and done things that contradict previous popes, just period, and contradict church teaching at times. And so therefore, the pope-splaining option isn't an option. Fourth option is deny a bad pope as a pope, but this time we look at him as a divine oracle theory, that basically what we do is we say, well, he's the pope. He can change things if he wants. Yeah, sure, he says this, and that contradicts the past. He says the death penalty is bad and it used to be good. Well, the pope can do that. And so he's not a bad pope, because ultimately a pope can't be bad under this theory. And you'll see this with some liberal Catholics today are doing this, but honestly, they're just doing it for Francis. And if the next pope is more conservative, they'll abandon that. So that's another option. That one's obviously stupid as well, because the church has never said that the pope is a divine oracle, that he can never be wrong, and things like that. The fifth option is the one I want to explore. This is the one that I think is the most possible, which is we deny that the accepted theology is the official teaching of the church. What I mean by that is the accepted theology of the papacy. And by accepted, I mean something very specific here. That is, and Thomas Pink actually wrote about this, has written about this before, and I think what he says about this is a very good point. And that is that accepted theology, he calls it official teaching, I call it accepted theology, meaning what Catholics around the world just kind of assume about the teaching of the church, what they assume about how we do things and what we believe. But it's not actually binding by magisterial authority to believe these or do these things. One example I would give is the ecumenism, the practice of ecumenism. Now, I've written a book about this, Deadly Indifference. Get it at your local bookstore. Actually, probably won't be at your local bookstore, because there are no local bookstores anymore. So buy it, not at Amazon, but at sophiainstitute.com or my website. But the point is, ecumenism this is something that is completely accepted. It's an accepted theology among Catholics today, that we are should engage in theology, we should engage in ecumenism, we should practice it, and we should interact with all with Protestants and others in this in a certain manner. But if you look at the history, you know that this is just started in the 1960s. Before that, ecumenism was condemned by the Catholic Church. And so it's not possible for both to be completely true. What it is this is more of an accepted theology. The way we look at things, ecumenism is, but it's not something binding on a Catholic. So, for example, a Catholic does not have to be ecumenical with his Protestant neighbor. He doesn't have to say, oh, let's find out how we share in things. He can say, listen, you're in danger of going to hell. You need to convert to Catholicism because Catholic Church is the one church founded by Jesus Christ and your church is a bunch of heretics. He can say that if he wants to. He can believe that if he wants to. He should believe that. But the point is that that's not acceptable. That's not the accepted theology of the church today, but it's not something binding on Catholics. Another thing that's kind of accepted, another example of accepted, which is a little more closer to our point here, is like how bishops interact with the Pope and how they treat the Pope. I mean, I just saw where Cardinal Gregory, I think it was, in Washington, D.C., was talking about how he's so upset about the division in the church in America, like he hasn't caused a lot of it. And he's upset because, you know, he just wants to promote and practice Pope Francis's ministry. He wants to further Pope Francis's ministry, as if the job of a bishop is to promote and further the ministry of the current pope. That's accepted by most Catholics today. When I worked for a diocese, the bishop there, he very much saw himself as a person who should be preaching the gospel, so to speak, of the current pontiff. I think most bishops think of it like that. They wouldn't say that explicitly because they know that sounds bad, but essentially they see their role as furthering the ministry of the pope, of the current pope. And that's all they're supposed to do. And that's an accepted theology. But the fact of the matter is that accepted theology is not binding magisterial teaching. And so it is possible for us to question it and to rethink it. And that's what I'm talking about here with the aspect of the papacy. I am not, just want to make sure I'm very clear about this, 12 minutes in, I want to make sure everybody knows, I'm not rejecting the papacy. And I don't think anybody else should either. I think, in fact, everybody should embrace the idea of the office of the papacy in the true Church of Jesus Christ. But I do think that our accepted views, our accepted theology of the papacy can be changed. And actually, I think it should be changed. And I think that Francis is just a symptom of the problem. I think John Paul II, we saw it a lot with him as well. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. But the idea of Francis isn't the problem as much as he's a symptom. He is exploiting, consciously or unconsciously, he is exploiting these problems with our accepted view of the papacy. Now, before I go on, let me just go through the different, what I would say are the different current modern views of the papacy. The number one view, which is the most dominant one, is the Roman, kind of the modern Roman Catholic view. This view is a papal maximalist view, I guess you would say. It believes that the papacy is really the center of the entire Catholic universe, that we should be basically looking to the Pope for our marching orders practically every day. That if the Pope says, okay, now we have to be concerned about the environment, well, we better be concerned about the environment. If the Pope says, now we have to get vaccines for COVID, well, we all need to get vaccines for COVID. If the Pope is, you know, says the death penalty is now inadmissible, well, now it's inadmissible. This is a papal maximalist view that I think most people, most Catholics, I'm talking about practicing Catholics, most Catholics would embrace today. It very much flows from Vatican I. It is a very idea of a robust papacy. But here's the other key. It includes a papal veneration. And by that, I mean a veneration for the person who occupies the chair of Peter. And by veneration, I don't mean just a submission or a respect for. I mean beyond that, almost like what the veneration we give the saints. In fact, we're seeing that today with the fact that most popes, modern popes, are now being canonized. I mean, there's even talk now of canonizing John Paul I, as if that's some help for the Catholic Church, for Catholics to know that a guy who was pope for 28 days or whatever it was, like a month, is a saint, is canonized. I don't see how that's a role model for most of us. But this idea of we venerate the current pontiff. And so we look to him as an example of holiness, as an example of orthodoxy, as the example that we're supposed to follow. Now, those of us who know history know this is a joke. The idea that you have to venerate the current pontific, the current pope. I mean, if we live in the 10th century, would we do that during the pornocracy? When basically the popes were just, it was just a family office that just terrible men were part of. And, you know, obviously we see that in the Middle Ages, later Middle Ages as well. And so the idea that we're supposed to venerate, but that's the common modern view. And so the idea that we don't venerate the pope is actually seen as somehow anti-Catholic. You're not really being a good Catholic if you don't venerate the pope. Not just respect him or expect him, even respect him, but, you know, not just think, okay, his office is part of the divine office of Jesus Christ that he gives, the divine man he gives to the church. And so we venerate. That's one view of the papacy. That's the dominant view of the papacy. Another view, though, is the kind of more older Roman Catholic view that pervaded, for example, during the whole first millennium of Christianity. Where it was more of a papal minimalist view. Not that they rejected the papacy, they didn't. Not that they didn't think that the pope had authority over the universal church. It was more the idea that my daily life as a Catholic doesn't revolve around the pope. And the fact that the pope won't really get involved in 99.9% of the matters of the church. Things that go on in a diocese in the middle of England, for example, it doesn't concern the pope, and it shouldn't concern the pope. And this is a view that really, and you know, that was very prominent for the first 1,000 years of the papacy, really until Gregory the Seventh. Oh, if I got that wrong, that's embarrassing. Gregory the Seventh in the 11th century, that really began to increase the authority of the pope in practice. Another idea that we see here is, like, you know, one example of this is that a lot of Catholics don't know that it's a modern practice for the pope to pick every single bishop in the world. That only came, I think it was in the 19th century, might have been early 20th century, I think it was 19th century, when that finally came into place that the pope would pick every bishop in the world. Before, for the longest time, local churches picked their own bishops. They just had maybe all the priests of the local diocese would get together and they'd elect the pope. I mean, not pope, a bishop of their diocese. And so this idea that the pope picking all the bishops is a more modern practice of the church. And so the first view, like I said, is the modern Roman Catholic view, which is the prominent one, a papal veneration, papal maximalism. The older Roman Catholic view is more of a papal minimalism, or at least not quite maximalist view. John Henry Newman, Saint John Henry Newman, he held to this view, the older view of a more minimal view of the papacy and what it should do. And so I, you know, he is a saint for today, I think, in understanding the papal office. Now, another view, so that's the second view. The third view is what I call the Eastern Catholic view, because it is the Eastern Catholic view. And this much more coincides with the older Roman Catholic view. This is the idea of a papal minimalism again, in communion with the church, with the pope, but you mostly ignore him. He really had nothing to do with the running of your church. A lot of people don't understand Eastern Catholics. I'm hoping to have a guest on in the next few weeks that will talk about Eastern Catholicism and how it interacts with the Catholic Church, how it's part of the Catholic Church, but it's not the same thing as the Roman Catholic, the Latin Church. But the Eastern Catholic view would see the papacy as part of the church. It's a valid office, and that the pope does have ultimately universal jurisdiction, in the sense that he can decide on different matters. But if you talk to most Eastern Catholics, they just don't spend their time thinking about what the pope says. It's not part of their daily life. In fact, I think most of them, unfortunately, the pope even picks the patriarchs and bishops of the Eastern Catholic Church, which I think is a shame. He really shouldn't. But I think, I think most Eastern Catholics would prefer that he didn't. That's the Eastern Catholic view. Now, the last two views I just want to mention, modern views, would be Eastern Orthodoxy and Protestantism. Obviously, Eastern Protestantism just rejects the office of papacy out of hand. We're not going to concern ourselves with that. Eastern Orthodoxy Just so people know, Eastern Orthodoxy does accept a limited primacy for the Bishop of Rome. I mean, they think the Bishop of Rome has fallen heresy, so he's not really has any authority right now. But assuming he goes back to Orthodoxy, as they would call it, he would have a certain primacy in the church. So it's kind of like the Eastern Catholic view is kind of a midway point between Eastern Orthodoxy and like the Roman Catholic view. Okay, another thing I wanted to warn people about before I continue is I'm already at 20 minutes and most of my single episodes like this go only for a half hour. I have a guess I'm going to go a lot longer than that today because I still have a lot to say. Because this all, just an aside real quick, I this topic came up for me over a year ago. I thought I'd write an article about it. And then as I started writing, it just got, my notes got so long. They just went on and on and on until finally I was like, oh my goodness, this is going to be a booklet. And then I was like, this might be a book. And so that was a year ago and I still have notes on it. I have an outline and I wanted to just kind of talk about here in the podcast. My hope is that eventually maybe this would be a longer article, a booklet, or even a book someday. Now, let's get back to the point. Okay. When we talk about the papacy, there's three aspects that I think are important. Make sure on my video you can see my three fingers holding up. Three aspects of the papacy that I think are important. The first one is what's the official teaching of the church when it comes to the papacy? The second is the exercise of the papacy, meaning how does the current occupant of the Bishop of Rome, how does the current occupant chair Peter, how does he actually exercise and practice his papacy? And the third is, what is the Catholic attitude towards the Pope? What does the average Catholic think of when he thinks of the Pope, of the papacy? How does he treat the papal office? Those are the three aspects that I want to look at, and I want to rethink each of the three. I want us to consider rethinking each of these three. All three of them come together to form what we call the papacy, the official teaching, the exercise, and our attitude. All those things come together to form what is now the modern papacy. And I want to rethink all three of those aspects. So the first is that we want to, the first is the hardest, and that is official teaching. Obviously, as Catholics, we know we can't contradict official church teaching. We can't go against what the church teaches. And so we don't have a lot of wiggle room here for what we can do when we talk about rethinking official teaching. But I do think that there are some aspects that we need to look at when it comes to the official teaching. I think, for example, we still have not truly understood Vatican I. I know the big debate today is Vatican II, and we feel like we haven't truly incorporated Vatican II into the church. And I would say that that's probably, there's a reason for that, but that's another podcast. I don't think that the church has truly understood Vatican I. I think that if you look at Vatican I, we have a very simplistic way of looking at it. That in the simplistic way is Vatican I gave the Pope all complete authority and he can do whatever he wants and we just have to grin and bear it. No matter what, he has complete authority to do anything. He can change the liturgy. He can change the teachings on moral teachings. Basically, he can change anything. He can do whatever he wants. I put this thought experiment on Twitter one time. What if the Pope Francis tomorrow said, I'm going to abolish all the Eastern Catholic rites? Everybody has to do the Novus Ordo, even the Eastern Catholics. Do we think he has that authority? I would say no, he actually doesn't have that authority. But a Vatican II zealot would say, oh, no, he obviously has the authority. It says he has universal jurisdiction. He has ultimate authority. He can do it. I don't think he can. I think that because Vatican I, it's speaking by assumption and sometimes even explicitly that the Pope's authority flows from his role, his job, which is to hand on the tradition of the faith. It's the hand on the faith. If he's not hanging on the tradition, so that means he's not practicing the papacy, so to speak, which means he doesn't have that authority. So, for example, I would just say, no, the Pope doesn't have the authority to abolish Eastern Catholic rites, as just one example. Now, I think that's something that the church really needs to look at more carefully and understand more fully. What are the limitations of papal authority? Some would say there are none, but I would say there are limitations of papal authority. But we have a very one-sided view of that based on Vatican I, to be honest. And so I think that's one thing we could do when we're talking about rethinking. Also, when it comes to rethinking the governing authority of the Pope, it's true. The Vatican I says he has universal jurisdiction. I don't think there's any way you can get around that. I would say, though, even there, though, if you look historically at how the Pope has exercised his office, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, we see the Pope has different roles as a teacher and as a governor. I mean, he has authority. He's the Bishop of Rome. He's the Primate of Italy. I think he's the Patriarch of the West, although Pope Benedict dropped that title. He did have that title for a long time. He's the Supreme Pontiff. I think there's different levels of his teaching, and I think that needs to be more clearly delineated by the church. Like, what does it really mean when he releases an encyclical? What does it really mean? Another, like, one for example is in the Code of Canon Law, it says that when it talks about, I think I have, do I have this saved? I thought I saved this somewhere. Maybe I do not. Okay, let me look it up here real quick. In the Code of Canon Law, it talks about papal infallibility. And one of the things it says, and I apologize, I thought I had this right in front of me, but obviously I don't. It basically talks about infallible teaching, and it says that any infallible teaching is clear. It's clear to the faithful that it is infallible. Right there, there's a limitation of what's infallible. If the faithful don't think it's an infallible teaching just because it hasn't been made clear it is, then it's not infallible. So there's a limitation, so to speak, of the papal teaching office. Now, when we talk about also the papal teaching office, I did have it written down. Sorry about that, guys and gals. It's Code of Canon Law 749. So let me look that up. I thought I had bookmarked, but obviously I didn't. But I do have it written down. 749, number 3. And what it states is, it's talking about papal infallibility. It says, no doctrine is understood to be infallibly defined unless it is clearly established as such. Because there's a lot of debate on what are infallible teachings. A lot of people would say, well, yes, obviously the teaching on the Assumption and the Immaculate Conception, they're both infallible. But for example, what about the Pope's teaching on the immorality of birth control, humanae vitae, or the Pope John Paul II talking about priesthood reserved to males only? I think both those things are infallible, but were they infallibly defined by the Pope there? Or were they already infallible? I'd say they were infallible. But the point is that there's some limits to infallibility. But really, it's the non-infallible teachings that we have to really rethink what our attitude is supposed to be towards these non-infallible teachings. So, for example, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we have popes like Pope Leo the 13th, Pope Pius the 11th, who were saying things like, here's Leo the 13th. If in the difficult times of which our lot is cast, Catholics will give ear to us meaning the Pope, as it behooves them to do, they will readily see what are the duties of each one in matters of opinion as well as action. As regards opinion, whatever the Roman pontiffs have hitherto taught and shall thereafter teach must be held with a firm grasp of mind, and so as often as occasion requires, must be openly professed. There's Pope Leo XIII basically saying, if it's the Pope's opinion, you have to follow it. Pius XI in the 1930s said something very similar, and it said, you know, that basically it's not just... even that they must obey only those matters in which she has decreed by solemn definition as though her other decisions might be presumed to be false or putting forward insufficient motive for truth and honesty. Quite to the contrary, a characteristic of all true followers of Christ, lettered or unlettered, is to suffer themselves to be guided and led in all things that touch upon faith or morals by the Holy Church of God through its supreme pastor, the Roman Pontiff, who is himself guided by Jesus Christ our Lord. if you read that, if you see, read those two these quotes, it sounds very much like we're supposed to follow the Pope on everything he says. On faith and morals, it does say that. But it basically that we're supposed to just follow that. And then this view of that we're, this is a modern view. It, this was not what was held in the Middle Ages. This is not what was held in the first millennium. This is a more modern view that we're supposed to hold to everything that the church, that, that the pontiff says. And this was culminated at Vatican II. Let me pull this up. At Vatican II, Lumen Gentium 25, it states, religious submission of mind and will must be shown in a special way to the authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff, even when he is not speaking ex cathedra. His supreme magisterium is acknowledged with reverence. The judgments made by him are sincerely adhered to according to his manifest mind and will. Did I cut out the most important part? I think I did in that. That he, that basically the submission, I'm going to, oh boy, I botched that quote. I had it up here and I think I missed the most important part, which is where basically Lumen Gentium says that we must follow. Here, let me get my notes. Boy, this is, here we go. Okay. The religious submission of mind and will. Yeah, there we go. The religious submission of mind and will must be shown in a special way to authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff, even when he's not speaking ex cathedra. His supreme magisterium is acknowledged with reverence. The judgments made by him are sincerely adhered to according to his manifest mind and will. Okay, first let's go to that. Religious submission of mind and will. This has been, this phrase here, this passage from Vatican II has been the hammer that has been used to beat on anybody who dares oppose anything Pope Francis says. It's Lumen Gentium 25. We're supposed to give religious submission of mind and will even when he's not speaking ex cathedra. But there are some qualifications here. It says the authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff. First of all, what is that? It also says, according when he's saying something according to his manifest mind and will, and it later defines and says, his mind and will in the matter may be known either from the character of his document of the documents, from his frequent repetition of the same doctrine, or from his manner of speaking. And so the idea is that we're supposed to give religious submission of mind and will to the authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff. I think, honestly, this is what we have to rethink. This passage from Lumen Gentium 25, I think, has to be really examined and rethought. Because what has happened is, the way it is currently written, it has created a loophole a truck could grab drive through that has led to people saying that we have to get the COVID vaccine because the Pope wants us to. I mean, I've seen that explicitly, that people think you're not giving your religious submission of mind and will to the authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff if you don't get the COVID vaccine, which is ridiculous. Now, some people could say, well, it's just a bad interpretation of Vatican II. Okay, possibly. The point is that we need to make this clear. The church needs to make this clear that we are not mindless robots that just have to follow anything and everything a pope thinks or says on a plane or wherever. But we are to be Catholic, and that means it's a more totality than just we follow the pope in everything we do. Okay, so that is kind of some just thoughts on how we rethink the papacy, the official teaching. Now, again, not a lot of wiggle room there, but I do think we need to have theologians and others to really look at Vatican I again, look at Lumen Gentium 25 again, and come to a better understanding of what those things mean that don't just end up being, okay, whatever the Pope says, we just have to follow no matter what, because we know that's a disaster. That's what's happening now. Now, we also need to, I think we should rethink the exercise of the papacy, meaning how the papacy, oop, almost knocked my camera down. Hopefully it'll stay up. How the papacy is practiced. Now, this is one that obviously we need a good pope to do. A bad pope is not going to do this because they're just going to want to have power and do whatever they want. But this is something I do think harkens back. We look at the tradition of the church. We see that popes have not always exercised the office like they do today. In fact, the vast majority of popes have not exercised the office of the papacy like modern popes do. This is a very modern way of exercising the papacy, to have a total control of everything. I already mentioned the point about bishops being appointed, every bishop in the world being appointed by the bishop, by the Pope. That's a modern practice. It doesn't have to happen. And I would argue it shouldn't happen, that we should not have a situation where the Pope picks every bishop. Because I know what especially Americans are thinking. Oh, we're going to get even worse bishops. If you have like the bishop, the priests in Chicago, for example, pick their own bishop. Oh my gosh, what is that? Or you like lay people get involved, whatever. I think though we should be more realize that I think we could have some good, a lot better bishops than we currently have if local churches were allowed to pick them. Or even if it was done on a national level, I think it would be better. Because I think you could have a lot of people involved that it's not such a bureaucratic process that has a very cookie cutter way of looking at what a good bishop should be. You might have somebody, a diocese in Texas, for example, have a very different idea of what a good bishop is than a diocese in England, you know, just as an example. And if you look at how the exercise of the papacy, there's other ways it could happen. For example, I think a pope could make it very clear. He could delineate what he means when he's teaching, what level of authority he intends to have in this. He could say things like, oh, you know, this is my opinion. This is what I think should be done. Pope Benedict, when he wrote the Jesus in Nazareth series, he said this in there explicitly. This is not an exercise of the papal office. I think that's a good thing for popes to do. Instead of being like, hey, look to me for your opinion on everything, they could say, listen, this is just my opinion. Honestly, one great way a good pope exercises his papacy is to stop talking so much. He doesn't have to give his opinion on everything like he's a world leader, that a thought leader or influencer on Instagram or something like that. He doesn't have to give his opinion on every single thought. That's what causes this problem of Catholics looking to the pope, what am I supposed to think about everything, which is not a Catholic way of looking at things. You know, Pope Gregory the Great, he actually had a very different understanding of how the papacy was exercised than popes do today. He did not like this idea of a universal pastor in the sense of somebody who was trying to direct the entire church every day. I mean, he definitely believed in the primacy of the papacy. But if you look at his writings, in fact, he rejected the term ecumenical patriarch because he didn't think anybody was over the entire world, ecumenical meaning the universal church. And he very much saw his role, his day-to-day role, was mostly as Bishop of Rome and primate of Italy, that area, and basically the West. He did not see himself as, okay, I'm going to insert myself into all the debates over in the East or something like that. I think that's something I think modern popes, it'd be very good if they did that today. Now, but again, here's an issue of where it's going to take a good pope to basically be an example for this. So that's the exercise of the papacy, I think we have to rethink it. The final way I think we need to rethink the papacy, and here's something we can actually do. I'm getting to the point where us lay Catholics can actually do something about this. I think we have to change our attitude towards the papacy, towards the pope. I know a lot of people have done this just by force because of the way Francis has been acting. But I do think that we need to change our attitude towards the Pope. I think the number one thing we have to do is to drop the cult of personality. This is something, let's be honest, this is something conservative Catholics were the most guilty of. I will put my hand up as the first among those under John Paul II. I actually had it more under Benedict XVI, to be honest. We had a cult of personality with the Pope, that we looked to him as the answer to everything. I remember getting debates with liberal Catholics back then, the 1990s, the early 2000s, where it'd be debating about something, and I would just say, like the all male priesthood, I would say, well, the Pope said there's no male priest, so therefore there's no male priest. And that was my argument. That's a terrible apologetical argument. The reason the Pope said there are no male priests is because the church has always taught there are only male priests, because the church has always taught that. It's not the other way around. The church doesn't teach it because the Pope said it. The Pope said it because the church teaches it. That's the case for all church teaching. It's not the church teaching because the Pope said it. The Pope says it because it's church teaching. That's our cult of personality we've gathered, though, where all of a sudden we want the Pope to be our final and our only line of defense against attacks against the church. We have to drop that cult of personality. I also think we need to embrace a more, frankly, like an Eastern Catholic view, that we don't look to the Pope in our daily lives and say, okay, what does the Pope say about this? What does the Pope think about this? Oh, that's how I'm going to form my opinion based upon what the Pope says. That's not, by the way, what Lumen Gentium 25 says. That's not what Vatican I said to do anyway. So we should stop doing that, where we look to what the Pope says. And yes, I acknowledge this goes against what the kind of the attitude of Leo XIII or the Pius XI. They very much had an attitude that we should form our opinions around what the Pope thinks. And I think that's just, that's a recipe for disaster. And we should stop doing that. We should go back to a more traditional, what I would say is a more traditional. Remember, traditional Catholicism isn't, okay, let's go back to how things were in 1920 and do that. That's a very poor view of what traditional Catholicism is. Traditional Catholicism is, we look at the entirety of the tradition of the Catholic Church and we embrace that. And that's what I'm talking about doing. I want to give one more final example of one more final example of how we can change our attitude. And this is a specific title. And this might be the place I get in the most trouble. It's the title Vicar of Christ for the Pope. We all know this title as a title for the Pope. I don't think most of us know the history, and I don't think most of us know the purpose of it. And I think most of us abuse the meaning of Vicar of Christ. Vicar of Christ, the first time that was used in relation to the Pope was in the late 5th century, Pope, what was it? Pope Gelatus, I can't remember. He basically, what happened was, is he was at a Roman Synod, I'm sorry. And he made a ruling, and those at the Synod said, rising to their feet, all the bishops and presbyters shouted in Synod, Christ hear our prayer, long live Gelatius. This was said 15 times. In you we see the Vicar of Christ. This was said 11 times. In you we see the Apostle Peter. This was said 6 times. Long live his see too. This was said 37 times. So that's the first place where we got Vicar of Christ applied to the Pope. The fact is that the title Vicar of Christ was actually applied to bishops in general, individually, I should say, and also to emperors and kings. They were seen as vicars of Christ, meaning they were representing Christ to the people. A bishop could be a vicar of Christ, an emperor or a king could be a vicar of Christ. The Pope was known as the Vicar of Peter because he was seen as a representative. And that's what vicar is, a representative of Peter. However, in the early 13th century, Pope Innocent III, he decided that he wanted Vicar of Christ to be exclusive to the Pope, and also that he wanted to drop Vicar of Peter. He's like, no, the Pope is the Vicar of Christ. And there's a lot of reason for this, a lot of political reasons, things like that. But the point is that Vicar of Christ is not a title that was given, that was used for the Pope in the first millennium. And it wasn't even until the 13th century it was really exclusively applied to the Pope. It was applied. In fact, Vatican II calls bishops vicars of Christ at one point. And although I'm not a huge fan of Vatican II, it was right to do so. That is a title they've been given. So the meaning, though, behind even the term Vicar of Christ, it was meant to be the idea of there are two heads of the church, so to speak. There's only one head of the church. There's the invisible head and the visible head. The invisible head is Jesus Christ. The head on earth, the visible head, is the Pope. Now, he's not a second head of the body. Instead, he is a representative of the invisible head, Jesus Christ. He is a vicar of Jesus Christ. And this was seen in his governing role, that he was to be the Vicar of Christ, meaning he's representing to the people the kingship of Jesus Christ, so to speak. That's how he was a Vicar of Christ. And so it really wasn't seen as something like he's representing in his person Jesus Christ, or he's acting like Jesus Christ, or look at him as a model of Jesus Christ. Instead, he simply is Christ who is in heaven, ascended into heaven at the right hand of the Father. He rules the church, obviously, from heaven, in an invisible fashion. And his visible vicar, his visible representative, is the Pope. But what's happened is that the application of that has gotten so much worse. so much more expansive, which I think is worse, is probably a more accurate way to put this. And if you notice, what happened is it's become, for example, that he's impeccable, basically. I know Catholics will deny they think that, but in practice, that's exactly what they do. They say, well, would the Vicar of Christ do something like that? The Vicar of Christ can't do that. He's the Vicar of Christ. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't lead you astray. The Vicar of Christ says you need to do this, so you need to do it. It's become a title that basically means he is Jesus Christ. And so if he says it, or if he does it, or if he thinks it, or if he suggests it, it's like Jesus Christ did. I think some of the foundation for that, you see this in the Middle Ages, starting at St. Catherine of Siena. I love St. Catherine of Siena. And obviously she challenged the Pope, but she would call him Sweet Christ on Earth. And I'm sure as a saint, she had a very proper attitude. Obviously she challenged him. So even though she called him Sweet Christ on Earth, she was willing to challenge him and tell him he was wrong, which she would never do to Jesus Christ himself. But what's happened is that's evolved, developed in a bad way, that we look at him like we can't ever challenge the Pope. We can't ever, you know, resist him to the face, as St. Paul would say. And so I would argue that one way, one practical way we can rethink the papacy is to really relook at this title, Vicar of Christ. Maybe we should go back to calling him Vicar of Peter. Maybe it's not like Vicar of Christ, that title is some infallible doctrine of the church that we have to always use or something like that. That's not how it works. Maybe we should just go back and call him Vicar of Peter instead of Vicar of Christ. Or if we do call him Vicar of Christ, we understand the limited application of that. It does not mean his every thought is Christ. It does not mean his every opinion is Christ or anything like that. It simply means that he can, that he governs visibly for Jesus Christ, who is the true head, invisibly in heaven. Okay, so yeah, this is a good question, but I can't answer it here. Somebody said, can you talk of the consequences of the Pope and how Eastern Orthodoxy is fair without a universal leader or a leader without universal jurisdiction? I do think that is further beyond what I can talk about here, but here's what we're going to do though. Our next episode of Crisis Point, actually, I'm going to have a guest on. We're going to talk about Eastern Orthodoxy and why Catholics should not become Eastern Orthodox in this crisis. We have a crisis in the Catholic Church, and Eastern Orthodoxy can look attractive to Catholics. We're going to talk about in our next podcast why we don't think that is actually a good option. Okay, I am super long today. I'm at about 47 minutes or so. So let me just give some conclusions here. You know, like I said, I'm probably getting in trouble with this one. Basically, what I'm calling for is a rethinking of the papacy, not a rejection of the papacy, a rethinking of how Catholics understand the role of the Pope in the life of the church, the daily life of Catholics, but also in the running of the church, how things are done in the Catholic Church. I think we have a hyper papalism in the church today, a papal maximalism that is very unhealthy, where our entire world revolves around our entire religious world revolves around one man. And I think that's unhealthy, and I think it contradicts how Catholics practice their faith for 1900 years. I think instead we should have a more minimalistic view of the papacy, not rejecting it. We still keep the papacy. It's still necessary to have a papacy. But what we do is we have a more minimalistic view of the papacy, that where we don't look to him for every thought. Like if the Pope says something crazy, it just doesn't even bother us. We're like, whatever. That's his opinion. And only when he's teaching as the Supreme Pontiff that we say, okay, now we have to listen to everything he said, to listen to what he's saying and how that is guiding the church. So that's basically my conclusion of what I'm coming to. And like I said, I've been working on this for a while. I'm still writing notes. I'm kind of thinking this out loud. Some of this is honestly thinking out loud, but hopefully together, what we can do is come to a better understanding of the papacy, so that we can address the challenges in the modern world and be, frankly, better Catholics and have a more robust church that's not racked by scandal because the Pope said something crazy on a plane. Okay, well, that's it. I'm going to wrap it up here. Until next time, everybody, God love you.